T2LIW here. At this time, we begin the second in line lock. T2KUI and T2LIW run this thing where we try to answer people's questions, usually on the subject of ham radio, but of electronic interest to ham radio. Any of those kind of subjects are appropriate. A person gives Mel and me your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes. Yes means that you do have a question or a comment for the net. So do we have any check-ins tonight? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
Okay, I'll say good evening. This is K2KUY.
Okay, we got Mel. Who else would like to check into the check net? Give me a call letters and name right now.
This is W2PNJ, Bob. No questions, just listening.
Very fine, we got Bob. Anyone else?
This is W2ANQ. Bill, good evening.
Very fine, Bill. And Bill, will you be having your question for us?
Sorry, no questions.
Okay, we got a pair of no's so far. Bill, Bob, and Mel. I guess pretty soon we'll have Paul, WS2N. Hopefully he's around to tell us what's going on in space. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call list and name right now.
KT2MDT, no questions.
We got Steve, anyone else?
W2BIE Lou, no questions. Good evening, Richard.
About time you sign in again there, Lou. And it's about time you give us a question or two.
One day I'll...
We're looking forward to that surprising day when you have some more questions for us. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now if you want to check into the TechNet. I think everybody's out on vacation, Mel. They're all out on their bicycles in their picnic favorite parks, visiting their mothers and their grandmothers, driving on the expressway and the New York Thruway. Oh, what's the latest? One more call. Who wants to check into the tech tank? Give me a call. What is the name? Okay. We're going to be spending quite a bit of time with emails this week, Mel. I see it coming. What's the latest in Manhattan Beach? And I hear tell there's a bit of a storm coming to us tomorrow. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, good evening all again. This is K2KEY. Yeah, I don't know. They always tell us about storms and all, but change the weather, continuously changing forecast, so we'll get the last minute forecast, I guess, sometime this evening, see what is coming up. I got a very interesting letter here from Doug, K2JJ, and he says we've been discussing a number of times problems with RFI with telephone, and he has a very elegant little filter that he got from somebody, some design, and it's very straightforward. Gee, it doesn't look like there's more than maybe a dollar or two worth of parts, but he says it works extremely well. And it has, let's see, 470 microhenry inductors. They had 2 3,000 PF disc taps. And, you know, three of them, 3,000 PF taps. And this filter will hold this CO, that's the AG6K dual pipe section, low-pass telephone RFI filter. And he says that it works extremely well. So, thank you very much, Doug. You're listening, KQJJ, for this information. And if anybody is interested in building this filter, you can go to Doug at ARRL. Doug's address is K2JJ at ARRL.net. So just want to acknowledge that, Dick, over.
Yeah, that's our favorite duck from Yonkers, I think it is. He's checked in a whole lot of times. Honestly, develops a rather nice product. So it can either be homebrewed with those components that I'm sure a person could get from DigiKey or other places. Nowadays, you can get components easier online than you can by walking into a store that used to sell them. In the old days, you could go to Harrison Radio, you could go to Lafayette Radio, and you could get parts. You can't do that anymore. So by way of DigiKey and similar catalogs, you can buy almost any number of parts you want. If in Manhattan Beach a person walked out of your front door mill and wanted to walk into a store where you could buy inductors, capacitors, where would he go? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Good question. This is K2KEY. First of all, I want to acknowledge that email that you sent to Dick. That's very, very good. And where would you go? You know, there isn't anything left in Brooklyn. Radio Shack has, you know, become now a completely different type of operation where they are more or less now in the retail sales of things, I guess, TVs. TV sets there and CCRs, of course, DVD players and a number of toys and things. There are some components, some little odds and ends in the back there, jacks and all, some drawers and things, some, you know, odds and ends hanging up, but nowhere, anywhere like you walk into, like, say, the Radio Shack and have lots of different things, catalogs. In fact, they had a commercial catalog that was very similar, almost like DigiKey, where you could find a lot of different things, ICs, capacitors, and all. Amazing how many different things, like I say, very similar to DigiKey's operation. And what you would do is you would go into the Radio Shack, your local Radio Shack, and give them the numbers of those parts, and they would put the order in for you, come back in a day or so, and it'd be delivered to that store. I believe that's discontinued. So the question is, where would I go out the door now, and where would I go for parts? And I tell you the truth, I have no idea. I know of one guy, if you want things like parts for, you know, old VCR, TV sets, he's got a lot of components, though, the back and it's around, and a lot of odds and ends, quite a bit of stuff. And that's out in out here in Jamaica. Place called All State Electronics. He happens to have a lot of stuff like replacement antennas for portable radios. What else did I get there? A couple of times, modules, you know, odds and ends that I needed. He's got a lot of things. You'd be amazed that he's been in business many years, so it's a very good chance you may find a lot of things there at All State. But he's not close by. He's out in Jamaica. You know, it's a bit of a ride. I mean, 35-minute ride, but that's probably trying to think of anybody else that I know of locally. There's nobody in Brooklyn. Place that did have quite a number of places at one time. Of course, like you mentioned, Manhattan, and that really was the mecca, but I think that has sort of also disappeared. Like you said, Dick, it's mostly, I guess, order of parts online. DigiKey seems to be the primary source. K2RIW and the TechNet, K2KEY.
Mauser, too.
Yeah, Mauser's another mail order catalog. So Allstate Electronics in Jamaica, and I think there is still a Spartan Electronics in the Comac area of Long Island. I'm not so sure if they're still selling the same kind of thing. Radio Shack has different sizes of stores. There is a super-sized store in Deer Park that still seems to have a whole lot of bubble packs with capacitors, resistors, and whatever. And I think you can get most of the values you need for a project like that, or at least close values, that maybe you can combine them in combinations in series and parallel and get the values you want. They also have these nice drawers which have got loudspeaker-like things. In other words, these are beeper things and power transistors and whatever. So there are some Radio Shack good-sized stores left that seem to have a good supply of components. But it's disappointing that that's kind of disappearing. Less and less home construction seems to be taking place. Was it now Harrison Electronics? Was one of the ones that was in Deer Park? Also with Arrow Electronics. Arrow Electronics had all kinds of parts in their storeroom. You could go there with a list. I want three of these disc ceramic capacitors and four of those resistors, and they had no trouble fulfilling that. And along came the bean counters saying that, hey, you're not making any money on these things. Well, that was very short-sighted. It was those needs that brought us to the store, which allowed us to then buy tape recorders and tape and appliances, televisions and whatever. It was the components that got us to the store. Once you're in the store, you saw the sale for the other thing, and you bought the other thing. The bean counters say you're not making any money on that. They eliminated the components, and a year later the store was closed because people didn't go there anymore. So it was the door opener, or the foot in the door, you know what I mean. So, and very similar things are happening in other industries. The most high-quality manufacturer of test equipment, electronic test equipment in the United States, for lots and lots of years, was Hewlett-Packard. And Hewlett-Packard had a monthly journal on the subject. Almost every single month they came out with a brand new product. Well, Hewlett-Packard also was selling computers. The computers are doing so much better that the bean counters said, gee, we're going to separate the computer operation from the instrumentation operation. That'll give us the ability to concentrate on instrumentation and give it the same profit margin they were getting on computers. Very short-sighted. That, of course, didn't really make any real change. And after that, they started removing all research and development for Hewlett-Packard and started outsourcing their manuals. In other words, the owner's manual is no longer written by the people. The software is no longer written by the Hewlett-Packard people. And in my opinion, the quality has changed considerably. Some of the modern-day equipment that they make is not as user-friendly as it used to be. And they've dropped their handheld computers. And they were one of the real leaders in that subject. So, there's got to be a better way. Okay, so JJ, K2JJ at ARRL.net is where you get a hold of Doug. And you get his schematic diagram for his telephone interference schematic diagram, which uses four capacitors and three inductors. Four inductors, three capacitors. And I imagine Doug could even start selling that if he wanted to. Or sell the kit that's got the parts and a small printed circuit board, if that's what's required. I presume it's got a printed circuit board. Okay, I'm going to make one more call. If anyone's got any questions for the TechNet, give me a call that is a name. If not, Mel and I are going to go start going down the list of emails. Mel tends to get an email or two per week when people ask some questions by that means. They seem to be a little bit too bashful to come on the air and ask that question, or maybe they don't have their ham license yet. They're listening to us on a scanner, and they can easily get to him by way of email. So, I'm going to leave a little bit of a delay. At the end of that delay, Mel, you pick up. K2KEY with a delay. K2RIW with anyone who wants to give us a call letter's name.
Nothing beats you, Zeddy X. This is one quick comment.
This is 2FLS. Yes, Mark.
K2QXMJ, yes.
Okay, we got Zeddy X, Mark, and Jay. Mr. Zeddy X, start up with your name. I should know it, and I don't. Go right ahead.
Hey, WB2ZX. Name is Jerry. I really can't say. Just want to make one other electronics store that still has parts. Anchor Electronics in on Liberty Avenue. Not Liberty, on one of the avenues in Richmond Hill.
So Richmond Hill, which I think is part of Queens, and also we've got the Allstate Electronics in Jamaica, also part of Queens, still selling components. Anchor Electronics. Good to know, Jerry. Thank you. Mr. FLF? Go right ahead, Mark.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, just a quick question. I've always wondered, and I'm sure you guys probably discussed it about 100 times already over the years.
the offset on the 2 meters, 440, 220, whatever, all of our VHF bands, UHF bands, who decided what they were? You know, why is there one makes put on 440 and yet it's only 600K here?
You said a one make split on 440. You mean five make split? I think it's five make split on 440. 600 KC split here. I think the split on something like 250 KC on 6 meters and 100 KC on the majority of the splits are determined by physics. The nicest way to run a repeater is to have a not a split site, but a single site repeater. The one antenna that does the transmitting and receiving is connected by a duplexing filter. The duplexing filter allows the transmitter frequency to go straight to the antenna, but blocks that frequency from getting to the receiver. And it allows the antenna coming down the antenna to get to the receiver and blocks it from getting to the transmitter. Depending on what frequency you're on, it takes a certain percentage of frequency separation in order to accomplish that. In the case of a good state-of-the-art 2-meter repeater, you would like the transmitter power that might be, say, 50 watts, and 50 watts is, let me think, 100 watts would be plus 50 dBm, so it's plus 47 dBm is the transmitter power. 47 dB stronger than 1 milliwatt is a 50 watt transmitter. You would like the signal getting into the receiver to be 120 decibels weaker than that, 147 minus 120. Anything stronger than that, the receiver is starting to become overloaded, and as such, it will give you some peculiar responses, intermittent distortion and whatever. Depending on what frequency you're on, Mark, it takes a certain percentage of separation to, with reasonable Q that you can get out of cavity filters, to get that amount of frequency selectivity. So you're trying to create a very deep notch at the receiver frequency from the transmitting port of the duplexing filter, and vice versa. If you're willing to use cavities that are as big as a house, you could do that with a smaller frequency separation. But of course, that becomes less practical. So I think that's the main reason. You first study the physics and realize what is easily realizable. And if it turns out to be a certain percentage of the frequency you're operating on is the separation you have to have in order to get enough filter action with reasonable size filters of reasonable cost and a reasonable number of them. Beyond that, it becomes a gentleman's agreement. In the case of the 600 KC separation for 2 meters, I imagine with the 2000 and above techniques, probably 500 KC could have been made to work. But at the day the decision was being made, 600 KC of offset for 2 meters was the agreed upon number. So I think that's primarily what's going on. I'm going to send it back to you, Mark. Drag your feet a little bit in case any other people have more knowledge about how it all came about. Mr. FLF to take it, a little bit of delay. KQLIW in the tech nation.
Okay, yeah, fine. Yeah, I meant to say five make before instead of one. That does make sense. I just, never realized it was so much involved. I just figured, yeah, let's do it this way. Okay, thank you very much for answering it.
In the case of cell phones at 900 megacycles, they use 45 megacycles of offset. Your transmit frequency is around 880, and your receive frequency for the base station is around 825, but the 45 megs of separation between what the car or what the handheld unit transmits versus, that's called the uplink, versus what the downlink transmits to you, 45 megs of offset. I should know, but I've forgotten the offset that's used on ham radio 1296. I don't think it's as big as 45 megs. In the case of cellular telephones, they use a much wider separation for a bunch of reasons. First of all, their duplexing filter is not just passing one frequency at a time. It's passing a whole group of frequencies 10 megacycles wide on the transmit side and 10 megacycles wide on the receive side. So to accomplish that kind of elaborate filtering requires a larger number of megahertz of offset between the two. It is kind of amazing if you think about it, that the exact same antenna can be transmitting as much as 100 watts in the case of some ham radio repeaters at the exact same instant of time that that receiver is receiving a slightly different frequency. And the good old electronics, the duplexing filter, the coaxial transmission line, going to one single piece of transmission line going to the antenna, keeps all that separate. However, to keep all that separate, you've got to do some magic. You've got to make sure that there is no pin of the connectors. That's called PIN, passive intermodulation distortion. If you have the slightest dissimilar metal or the slightest scratchiness of contact at the connector, which is carrying transmit frequency on the way up and receive frequency on the way down, if there's the slightest scratchiness to the tune of 1 micro-ohm, and I'm not kidding. In other words, you can have a milliohm or 50 milliohms of resistance as long as it's a steady resistance. But if there's a micro-ohm of scratchiness, a micro-ohm of variation of resistance versus time, versus the transmit cycle, then you get passive intermodulation distortion, in which case you and I recognize it as the scratchy. The slightest crack in the solder joints that are on the individual sections of a collinear antenna, a superstation master-like antenna, has been waving in the breeze for 5 years. The slightest scratchiness or a micro crack in the solder between those sections, where there's a micro-ohm of modulated resistance, it will give you the scratchies on a windy day. And you hear chunks of noise coming through the receiver when the transmitter is operating, even though the 600 kc apart on 2 meters, for instance. Another similar situation is the Goldstone dish. It's now 260, I think, feet in diameter. Goldstone, California. I've been there. It's inside of Fort Irwin, a military operation. A Army base is where the NASA site is located. And when they're talking to a spacecraft in the vicinity of a 10,000 watt transmitter at S-band frequencies, like roughly 2.2 gigahertz is transmitted at the exact same time that they're receiving a signal a couple of hundred megacycles away, and the signal they're receiving are signal strength like minus 135 dBm. So between their transmitter and receiver, they have separations in the vicinity of 160 decibels. In other words, the power ratio of what they're transmitting versus what they're receiving simultaneously, that power ratio, you put down 1 and put 16 zeros after it. That's the power ratio. And as such, very minor modulations can give them grief. There was a period of time when the Goldstone dish was used for talking to the Apollo astronauts when they were on the moon, and as the wind was blowing against the dish, the individual panels of the dish is 260 feet in diameter, the individual panels were about a meter square, and they held together with rivets. And as the wind would flex the dish, the slight flexing of the rivets of the individual panels was making noise. And so you would hear astronaut audio modulated by bursts of noise as gusts of wind were hitting that dish. The good news is the dish has a lot of gain on transmit and receive. The bad news is you require ridiculous linearity. If you and I calculated the modulation linearity required of that dish to sustain that simultaneous transmission and reception, it is definitely pushing the state of the art, the edge of the art. It's at the bleeding edge of what is realizable. You almost want to go out there and gold plate each one of those metal panels of that dish to make sure the junctions between the two have the best possible contact. So, kind of fun stuff. And if you calculated the amount of modulation the dish was creating by minor contact variations around the perimeter of the individual panels, my guess is we're talking about a micro decibel or a nano decibel of amplitude modulation at the dish. The direct measurement of what the dish was doing is way beyond the state of the art. of what you can measure directly. Measure the amplitude modulation the disc was creating because the wind was blowing against the panels and they got scratchy contacts at the edges. But the indirect measurement, simply turn on the transmitter, listen to the receiver a couple of hundred megs away, and listen to the noise burst coming through the receiver. That's the indirect measurement. And recognizing the problem took them a little while. I remember reading the report, one of the NASA reports on this subject, way back in the late 60s, early 70s. The Airborne Instruments Laboratory used to get NASA reports in their laboratory, in their library, and during my break periods, I would go to that library and read those NASA reports. Some of it's exciting stuff. So, look what you got us into there, Mark. Mr. FLF, for any further comments, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Oh, wow. And to FLF, Brady, very interesting stuff. It kind of makes you wonder why they didn't devise some system to weld those panels on the dish. I guess maybe if they replaced every now and then with the weather could, you know, probably beat the hell out of them over the years. Be rough to replace when they're welded. Must have been a hell of a lot of static there when those things were blowing.
Yes and no. It only come in bursts. Only certain panels were creating these scratchy contacts. And I guess the right solution, which I think they've solved since then, is to coat the panels with some kind of metal which doesn't have a corrosion problem. Nickel plating, gold plating, something along these lines is what's required to make the problem go away. Welding the panels is not necessarily the right solution because if all the panels were welded together, they wouldn't be able to flex against each other. Therefore, the dish would have two different shapes depending on whether it was a hot day or a cold day. On a hot day, the individual metal panels would grow, they would expand, and force the dish into an entirely new shape, if not creating a, you know, ripples like you get on a hot concrete road on a summer day, where you get ripples in the road, and ripples in the dish would be bad. But they did have to be able to move because of thermal expansion. Now, you take the modern-day equivalent of that, the very large telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia, 100 meters in diameter, 305 or 310 feet in diameter. I've been there and saw the construction of that dish. In order to solve that problem, because that dish is being used as a radio telescope up to and including 100 gigahertz. Therefore, they want those panels to the correct position of the nearest fraction of a thousandth of an inch on a dish that is 300 feet in diameter. That dish is a couple of acres of area. In order to accomplish that, at the corners of each individual panel, there is a servo motor, a gear motor, which can be ground, you know, with a gear train and a jack screw. Each individual panel can be tuned to the correct position in each of the corners of the panel. And how do they determine the correct position? There is a laser interferometer at the focal point of the dish. The focal point of the dish is a cast-grain like thing. It's got a subreflector to it. At the subreflector, there is a laser rangefinder that rapidly scans the little corner cube that's in the corner of each one of those panels, rapidly scans each one of them, and says, hey, panel number 421 is a little bit high on the left side and a little bit low on the right side. And the computer gathers all this data every few milliseconds, gives a command to those particular motors to take the high point and grind it down, take the low point and grind it back up, motor-wise, and now that dish is thoroughly adaptable. It can adjust itself to have the best possible shape as the dish is tilted at various angles in the sky, so gravity sag is happening, wind is blowing against the dish, snow load is happening to the dish, thermal expansion is happening to the dish, and that laser interferometer system is correcting all of that. Under normal circumstances, that dish, with the best methods of construction, would have a devil of a time holding enough surface accuracy to work at 2 gigahertz. Would have a devil of a job doing that. Would be a very serious design engineering problem to give it 2 gigs of accuracy. And by this automatic laser range-finding tuning technique, that dish is more than effective at 100 gigahertz, which is what? 50 times higher in frequency. So that is the world's premier radio telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia, at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Beautiful piece of hardware. 60 million pounds of rotating mass, thoroughly steerable in azimuth and elevation, all the way down to the horizon, all the way up to the zenith, across the whole hemisphere of sky that thing can see. It can scan not quite DC to light, but very low frequencies, up to 100 gigahertz. You walk across the surface of that dish, and you can set up a camera at the focal point of that dish, and the focal point is 450 feet higher in the air. And you take a picture of the dish. You have trouble recognizing the fact that there's a man standing in the middle of that dish. He's so small by comparison. And that dish itself, the rotating track for the azimuth rotation on that thing, is held to the nearest fraction of a thousandth of an inch as it rotates around in azimuth. And the whole thing goes down to virgin shale bedrock of West Virginia mountainside. What a piece of hardware. Back to you, Mark, for any further comments on that. I mean, is it Mark? Yes, Mark.
Wow. Very enlightening, I tell you. Amazing. Absolutely amazing what they can do. And, yes, that's a failure large, I believe.
Well, technology. I don't know.
Probably going to kill us sooner or later, fortunately. But, hell of a thing. Yeah, I've seen pictures like that here and there, where there is somebody standing on a dish, and you really have to see what that speck of dust is. Pretty cool. Thank you very much, Dick. I'll be listening to the rest of the net, as usual, and to FLS.
Yeah, so when it comes to radio telescopes, that's the state of the art, in my opinion. And when it comes to optical telescopes, they're starting to do a very similar thing. You can't make a mirror big enough. So therefore, you make the mirror in individual sections. The Keck telescope in Hawaii does a similar thing. It's made of, I think, 36 individual hexagonal panels. Each one of them is a thoroughly forward surface mirror built to the nearest fraction of a millionth of an inch of accuracy. And each one of those mirrors is tunable. So the dish comes up with higher accuracy. Now, you take that telescope and you take the one at European Southern Observatory, ESO, in La Salina, Chile. I got a buddy of mine who works there and talks to me periodically by email. FQ2SOD, I think it is. Here we go. Manfred Mortenwick is the next guy's name. What they're doing there is you build the biggest telescope you can with fractional sections of mirrors. Then you build two of those telescopes side by side. You optically connect them as a interferometer. When you start doing those techniques, you get higher and higher resolution, greater and greater sensitivity. And about 6 months ago, they proved the sensitivity of that super telescope they got in Chile on top of this mountain. It's about 10,000 feet up, and the place, gets a tenth of an inch of rain per year because it's so high up in the Andes Mountains of Chile. Beautiful place to run a telescope. Terrible place to locate human beings because it's a tough place to live where the air is so thin. And that's the one place on planet Earth, a little bit close to there where they're setting up some more telescopes. I can't think of the name of the place now. It's a desert, very high desert, where they've only had a tenth of an inch of rain in 10 years. And when you gather chunks of soil anywhere on planet Earth and you put it in a petri dish with the right kind of a medium, some kind of bacteria will grow. Well, in the case of the Atacama Plains, I think it's called. Anyhow, in the place of this, in this location on top of the mountain, the soil is so dry that nothing grows there. There isn't a single bacteria that seems to be there. You take a chunk of that soil, and you bring it back to your laboratory, and you put it in your petri dish, and you sit there and wait for a month, and nothing grows. That's the only place on planet Earth they've ever found that appears to have no life. And when my buddy Morton goes there to do any maintenance on the equipment, he tells me that the air is so thin, the air is so dry, we're talking about 1% humidity type stuff, that if you're not consuming something like a couple of liters of water per hour while you're there, your chances of surviving are not good. You leave a man there for about a day, and he's likely to become so dehydrated because every breath of air he takes, he's breathing out a tremendous amount of water from his lungs. His lungs have to have the water, otherwise they don't have the flexibility to work. But in the process, they're sacrificing moisture to the air, super dry air. And if you're not continuously consuming water, you won't survive there very long. And boy, is that a place to run a telescope. And you build a pair of these telescopes side by side, and all of a sudden you're getting to the threshold where you can start resolving planets going around suns that are outside of our solar system. Another thing they did recently to prove the sensitivity of that thing is they took Halley's Comet. Halley's Comet is considerably blacker than a piece of coal. And it goes out there, something like 70 astronomical units is the aperture of its orbit. We see Halley's Comet when it comes close to the sun, but of its 78-year orbit, for 30-some-odd or 40-some-odd years, it's way out there. And so picture a piece of coal 70-some-odd times further away from the sun than the Earth is. And they managed to take a photograph of Halley's Comet at the apogee of its orbit in order to gather the light coming from Halley's Comet in that situation. They set these two telescopes side by side, and then each telescope is 10 meters in diameter, 30-foot diameter optical telescope. And the light from Halley's Comet was one photon per 1.5 seconds. And they integrated that photograph for something like 2 or 3 days to gather enough light from Halley's Comet to get a dot on the photograph on the charge-coupled device camera, say, yes, that's what it was, after they removed the grayscale from everything else around and giving them straight light into the telescope. That was a magnitude 28 view. The human eye can see a star down to magnitude 6. Magnitude 28, 28.5 is what Halley's Comet was. And that, to my knowledge, is the dimmest object ever photographed on planet Earth. And exciting stuff. As you get more and more sensitive cameras and better equipment, we're going to get better and better pictures. We're already up to 230 planets being sent that are exoplanets. In other words, outside of our solar system, going around somebody else's star, we've detected 230 planets. We're starting to get the sensitivity by techniques that you're hearing about, where pretty soon we're going to find Earth-sized planets in the Goldilocks zone. And you could say it's only a small number of years before we're going to discover life elsewhere. Lots of people are starting to predict that. It's going to be exciting. Eventually we'll send a radio signal to them, and we'll have the big QSO in the sky. That's a bit of a stretch because of the delay time. And many of those stars are, you know, 10 and 20 light years away. That's going to be a pretty slow QSO. Something to look forward to, though. Okay, Jay's the next person. KC2QXJ. Go right ahead, Jay. K2RIW. May have your name wrong.
Yeah, to use subspace. That's a lot of wind decks, that telescope. Take care, Dick. Into us a lot.
Sure does. QXJ, you got it.
Okay, Dick. It's KC2QXM, Quebec X-ray. My first time on the net. And some very interesting stuff you can talk to that. But my question is pretty much elementary compared to what you've been talking about. I have in my mobile an IC7000, and I have 8-gauge wire running straight from my battery to the back seat, and then to a power block, a fused power block, and then I have the IC7000 mounted under the back seat, going straight to that power block. It's 8-gauge wire. Now my question is, do I have to, with the 8-gauge wire direct to the battery, do I have to worry about any kind of voltage drop?
I think the answer is no. 8-gauge is about as big as you want to use in a car, particularly the nicest way to do it is 8-gauge stranded. I would worry a lot about the degree of insulation of that wire. I'd worry about the grommet. In other words, to get that wire from your battery in the engine compartment of your car through the firewall into the back seat of your car, most likely you had to go through the grommet that exists at that firewall. And so any chafing that takes place at that grommet, the hole in the firewall to bring in that wire, is something to worry about. I would even consider putting an extra piece of spaghetti tubing over the wire in that area just to give it some extra insulation, because The good news about 8-gauge wire is it's about the lowest voltage drop you're going to get. And you can't go much better than that. And the nicest way to do it as far as electromagnetic interference is concerned is to have a pair of wires, a twisted pair of black and red, both coming from the battery. D plus in return. It's very tempting to use the grounding of the frame of the automobile as the negative voltage return. If you do that, you end up putting a little bit more RF energy into the automobile power system. By using a twisted pair, you get a tiny bit more voltage drop, but with 8 gauge, that ain't much. I've done that exact installation you've done, and it worked like a charm with my 160-watt Mirage amplifier, Baker 1016. I powered it exactly the way you're talking about, and that thing draws 25 amperes. I'm not quite sure, maybe your IC 7000 draws something similar. And the voltage drop I had there was very easy to live with. I do recommend a fuse at the battery for that beginning wire. It's very tempting to run the wire directly to your fuse block. From the fuse block, you then go to the radio and you say, hey, the system is fused. As far as the short as the radio is concerned, yes. But the thing you got to worry about most is that if that wiring from the battery should touch the chassis of the car anywhere, 8-gauge wire can draw so much current, it'll generate so much heat, it is capable of burning down your automobile. So you do need a, let me pick a number, 25 or 35 ampere fuse at the battery at the beginning of that wire. Not to protect your radio, to protect your car. A lot of people leave out that single fuse. You don't need a fuse on the, if you do run a pair of black and red leads from the battery, in my opinion, you do not require a fuse on the negative lead, because that one has essentially no voltage difference between the negative lead of the battery and the chassis of the car. They're at 0 volts potential, except for a few millivolts drop in the wiring. The advantage of you running the twisted pair is that any RF energy you put on that wire, if for instance you did run a Mirage 1016 amplifier, 160 watts and 2 meters, it tends to put a lot of RF energy back on the 12-volt wire. And if that wire is a twisted pair, it acts as a twin lead, it's a shielded transmission line, and it doesn't radiate into the car, and doesn't disturb the computer system of the car. So that's a nice way of running that. But from the positive lead right at the battery, I strongly recommend putting a fuse to protect your car. Other than that, I think you've done a darn good installation there, Jay. KC2QX Mike, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. Very informative. That answered my question perfectly. Yes, sir. I do have a fuse right on the power line, right at the battery, about 25 inch. I have both a black and a red lead going to my power block, which is also fused. And then the lead going to also came with the original fuse. So I think I'm pretty protected. And also the black and red wire that I have going through the firewall, I have going through an existing rubber grommet. So I don't think there's any chance of saving, because there was already an original manufacturer installed rubber grommet there. So I probably don't have a problem with that. But thanks for your thanks for the info. Very informative. And back over to you.
Very good, Jay. One of the things I worry about a little bit is that when you're driving on a wet road on a rainy day in the passenger compartment, the wheels of the car are kicking up all kinds of moisture. The fan in front of the radiator is kicking up all kinds of air and moisture. So there's a lot of swirling moisture in that engine compartment of the car when it's running. And any hole left over at that grommet that goes through the firewall is capable of slowly leaking that moisture, sometimes salt spray from the road and whatever, into the wiring of the car behind the instrument panel or behind the foot pedal, so to speak. So I'm not quite sure what the right answer is. I imagine a smart guy would, after the installation, spray some expanding foam in that area to try to seal it off. And the nice thing about some brands of expanding foam is that with your Swiss Army knife or a very dull bladed object, you can chip away the foam the next time you want to add some more wires to the firewall. but try to make a minor seal where that wiring goes through the firewall to stop all of that salt sprayed watery mixture on a rainy day from coming through that firewall and disturbing the wiring behind the panel in your car. I've seen one car where the panel was taken apart and a lot of corrosion existed in that area because for a long period of time salt spray and other things had been coming through that hole with the grommet in the firewall. Okay, let's see if we've gone through Jerry, Mark. I think we hit Jerry. Oh, Jerry said he had no questions on that number. And Jay. Anyone else with any questions before we go over to Mel starting to dig into his mailbag? Give me your call letters and name right now. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Let me make a comment on the last installation.
Go right ahead. Give us an improvement on that one, Mel.
I got a lot of wires coming through the firewall, so it's a lot mobile stuff. What I use is they got these tubes, that, you know, the black tube that's supposed to be called windshield sealer. Come, you can get it through, you can get it a number of ways. Things like heck, smells like vinegar when you put it on, but it seals real well. It's very rubbery. In other words, you know, it'll make a nice rubber that stays rubbery and seals the wire as you go through. I sealed a whole bunch of them that went through the firewall, Dick. Buy an auto supply device works quite well, and as you said, if you have to add wires, you can easily, you know, dig through it, you know, take it or pull it off or whatever. And I think they use a number of different wires. The one I use is black, but I think it comes in a number of different colors. What do they call it? Silicon sealer. I think it even comes in clear, if I'm not mistaken. I think you know what I mean. It smells like vinegar over.
Yeah, but I believe it's called windshield. Windshield seal. There's a similar material called duct seal, which is used on environmental chambers as a material that survives the weather very nice. Coax seal, the material you can buy in an electronics store, is close to what we're talking about. But that rubbery seal around windshields does an extremely good job. And I think you're saying in a good aftermarket automobile store, you can separately buy it. And any idea of how big a chunk you buy? Does it come in a block or in a can? What's it called? How many dollars? Back to you, Mel.
Don't spend all that money. Buy silicon bathtub sealer.
Okay, and silicon bathtub sealer probably comes in multiple colors. Probably comes in a nice squeeze tube. And where's your favorite place to buy it, Eric? And roughly how many dollars do you spend?
KB10 Kitty.
You can get it any hardware store, Home Depot, any place. Yeah, anywhere from like $3 to $5. Depending upon what you want to buy. What color comes in clear, it comes in all sorts of colors. The stuff that they package for electronics to it, the same stuff, they just charge more.
Good to know. KB1OQD, you got it.
Yeah, KB1OQD. Hello, Dick. Hello, Mel. Internet. Yeah, if you're looking for silicone, Mel was talking about there, you can go to Home Depot. There's a clear silicone. He's right. It's G8 something or whatever it is, name of it. But Home Depot sells it there. Don't use the tough stuff. It's not as good. They make a clear stuff. It's similar to what the window sealant is. But Home Depot carries it. And I'm using it for my light. When I had my light bar installed, I had to drill the 1-inch hole through the roof there. And I use that to seal it. And it works really great. And it comes in clear and it's very easily pliable. But it does have a good stink to it. I'll let you guys get back, but I let you know that info there as far as getting it at Home Depot, and it's not that expensive.
By the way, Dick, the smell is acetic acid, and I use it on all my antennas and everything else, and, you know, even with the UV, it lasts a lifetime.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask Bob. Bob, the stuff you buy at Home Depot, what kind of package? Talk to us slowly. You're talking very fast. Talk to us slowly. What kind of package is it in? What's it called? How many dollars? And if it's clear, I worry a little bit about if you're using it on the roof of your house, is it giving you ultraviolet protection? Most ultraviolet protected plastic-like materials are black in color. So a couple more words on that one, Bob. You got it.
Yeah, copy, Dick. It comes in clear. It's made by GE, I believe it is. And it comes in a tube. Not too long, it's maybe about
5-6 inch long tube, and it's a white tube, and it's a clear clear silicone there. Like I said, I've used it on the roof of my truck there when I ran the line in for the light bar, for the overhead light bar for the fire department, and it's been up there for 2 years, and it's shown no deterioration, still flexible, and it's, you know, it's last there. And I believe it says for window sealing and all purpose there. But like I said, Home Depot has it, or your hardware store. But I think GE makes a lot of that, most of that stuff.
PNJ.
PNJ recognized. I remember now that at Home Depot you could buy these tubes that look like a piston. It's got a great big spout on one end. You mount it into this structure, which has got a pistol grip to it. And as you operate the pistol grip, it goes click, 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 and it forces the piston out, and out comes this stuff. So you can buy silicon steel, well, I'm going to call it a elastic adhesive. What do they call it now? It's not thermal setting. It's room temperature, RTV, room temperature, vulcanized silicon steel. You can buy it in these piston tubes. And the good news is it's a handy way to put a lot of it in some place, like doing a roofing job. The bad news is those tubes go out of date in about 6 months, and they go, eventually the stuff starts hardening in the tube. Mr. PNJ, go right ahead.
Dick, I've been using silicone for 37 years in the electrical field. I've used all the ones that sell at Home Depot, the GE brand. Still, the finest silicone that holds up is the GE RTV 108. It's not sold in the homeowner market. You can buy it at GE Supply in Farmingdale. I buy it by the case. It's excellent all around. It's used outside all the time. And it's GE RTV 108. I buy it in the caulking gun cartridge. And yeah, I believe it's still available too if you want in a toothpaste tube type of unit. But I usually get it in the caulking gun cartridge. RTV 108, it comes clear, white, or black.
Fantastic. Okay, it comes in caulking gun. Now, you buy it by the case. Can I buy one or two tubes of the caulking gun size, or can I buy one or two of the hand-operated size? If I go to GE Supply in Farmingdale, which sounds to me like it's a wholesale dealer, how much will they sell me, Mr. PNJ?
If it's in stock, you can buy it by the tube, if it's in stock. And I'll tell you the truth, I've never bought one tube. I buy it by the case, which is, I think it's a dozen tubes per case. And the price is the same as the Home Depot product. I think $3 to $4 per tube. I mean, years ago, it used to be much less. But like anything, it's gone up. But GE Supply is an electrical supply house. You can walk in and buy over the counter. Anybody can buy there. And it's on New Highway, and it's south of Schmidt Boulevard, and it's on New Highway.
Good information, Bob. Those guys in Kings Park know where to buy stuff. Okay. Good stuff. That's the way to feel. Yeah, lots of us are scared to death to put a hole in the roof to do an antenna installation, and we run the cable, you know, some terrible zigzag direction around the eaves of the roof and whatever, simply because we're afraid we're going to develop a leak in the roof. With the proper techniques of sealing, like what you guys are talking about, running the cable a very short distance, particularly if you're running hard line, if I get to run straight and not make any bends in it, if you can do it, I don't think we should be so afraid of creating roof leaks. And even if at worst a roof leak did occur, it's fixable. Worst comes to worst, you eliminate the cable and cover it over with a panel of some kind, but I don't think you have to go there. With the proper techniques, I'm pretty sure we can run our cables through the roof. And my philosophy is that my house is that tool which keeps the rain off my ham rake. The wife doesn't quite see it that way, but from time to time, that's the way I see it. My house is a tool. My tower is a tool. Holds up my antennas. Allows them to see to the horizon and pick up all those great signals that are in the ether. Okay, anyone else with any questions? They want questions or comments? Give me your call letters and name right now. Kate.
One last comment. Kate.
Yeah. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I wonder you're talking about using RTV or silicone. I actually put it over when I build the beams and the other things that I put together on the roof. I actually coat all the screw heads and the screw threads with it. and anywhere that you make a connection. You know, it's a fabulous feeling. When it comes time to go take things apart or readjust it, you just peel the silicone away and it looks like it's brand new.
Okay, that's a great way to go. A lot of us from time to time attempted to use rustable fasteners and to cover them with elastic adhesive, particularly the end of the coax cable. If you've got a piece of hard line going straight to an antenna and you decided not to use a connector, that's a great way to go. My favorite way is to use stainless steel hardware, in which case you don't have to cover it. But there are times you don't find the right size of a washer or a nut or bolt or whatever in stainless. Now, Bob out of PNJ, I've got a question for you. The RTV-108 is your favorite one. It does the greatest job of weatherproofing, nicest to handle, and whatever. Do you have a guess as to why that model number, 108, is not sold in your normal hardware store and in your Home Depot? W2PNJ, K2LIW.
That's a good question. I know it's got the vinegar smell, the acetic acid, like all the others. But I've noticed the difference. When I want to do a nice job, I spit on the finger and I use the saliva to get a nice bead, like around if you want to cork around a meter pan and the siding of the house. Super product because it's tenacious. It's a sealant and also an adhesive. And I want to tell you, sometimes you got to take a razor to slice it off. Metal, you know, like a tube or a metal enclosure. But it's a commercial, I know it's a commercial line of the GE product, and I believe the color is dependent on either 108 is your clear, and it may be a 107.